I'm speaking tonight with Christopher Williamson of Chasing Earhart. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a bit about who you are?
Sure, Aaron. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. We're big fans of Generation Y, so thank you very much. Just to give you like a little bit of a little bit of exposition on who I am, about 9 years ago, I started conducting pre-research on a project that at the time I had no idea what it was going to become. It was just an untitled Amelia Earhart project. And this was kind of during the time where a lot of interesting developments were going on in the Amelia Earhart community, and a lot of the researchers that were out there were kind of coming through with a lot of different breakthroughs, and or at least breakthroughs on what they believed for their disappearance hypotheses and things. And so I was just kind of doing research, and I was collecting all this information and quietly building a guest list and for something that I want to do, some kind of a project. And about 2013, 2014, I decided that it was going to end up being a podcast, because at the time podcasts had really been big and really kind of sort of blown up. And I knew for me, you know, a podcast would be a relatively inexpensive way to reach out to all these folks, and it would give them all a great platform to kind of, you know, put their data out there. So we started doing that. We started reaching out to folks and kind of building a guest list, and we started with 25 names, and that guest list has now grown to pushing 200 at this point. And about a year and a half ago, if we fast forward to that, our project coordinator, Vanessa, who's also my wife, it basically had kind of let me know, hey, you should do a documentary on Amelia Earhart. And, I know back with the episode you guys have done, I'm sure you watched, you know, research documentaries. I'm sure all of us have seen documentaries on Earhart. They usually either skew one or two ways. They either are very, biased towards one hypothesis, whether it's a Japanese capture or Nikamaru or crash and sink or whatever you want to pick, or they gloss over a lot of the information and they spend, you know, 20 minutes talking about or 30 minutes talking about 40 plus years of research and 80 years since the disappearance. So, you know, I wasn't originally going to do a documentary, but I was convinced that if we were to flip it and talk about and focus about on how she lived instead of how she died, that would be a unique twist on the documentary. And if we were to look at all of the hypotheses regarding the disappearance case itself and look at that from a non-biased platform and really sort of present this information to the jury of public opinion and just not get in the way, not truncate anything, not object to anything, just put it out there, collect it, put it out there, and get out of people's way so they can kind of, you know, decide for themselves what they believe happened to Miss Earhart, Mr. Noonan 80 years ago. That would be the ticket. So that's what we've been doing. We started shooting the documentary in March of this year. We've got about 200 hours of footage already. We will probably have close to 2,000 hours, you know, based off our expectations on what we're doing in the shoot schedule for 2018 and a little bit into 2019. And we release episodes of the podcast every week. We just released episode 19, which was our second part of our Leo Bellarts conversation, which is one of our icon series episodes. And we'll keep going. The podcast has turned into a backbone. It serves the documentary well. It allows us to put out content constantly. And we, you know, the Chasing Earhart podcast is the only dedicated Amelia Earhart podcast on the planet. And we're proud of that. And, you know, we're working with that constantly while we shoot the documentary. So it's been a fun project, and we're just getting started, really.
As far as documentaries go, I might be wrong on this, but I feel like these days they're much more appreciated and people get much more obsessed with them. And it's, you know, back in the day, it was more of, oh, did you watch that documentary? Sure. Now, the dialogue that happens between people online is just ridiculous. There's so much of it.
Yeah, I agree with you. You make an excellent point there. I think that, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have seen the Making a Murder documentary on Netflix. I think it was 13 parts. It was a binge watching kind of experience, but that proved it. The Amelia Earhart Lost Evidence documentary that had almost 5 million viewers, which is the largest cable watch show this year, I think proved it. You know, people talk, and social media has played a big part in that. And people really get fired up about documentaries and doing research, and actually getting fired up about history is a really exciting thing. So all that plays right in our wheelhouse and kind of what we're doing and what we're trying to accomplish with Chasing Earhart.
There's something else that's going on where there are these documentary series, is what I would call them, that are focused on a single case. For example, you have The Hunt for the Zodiac Killer. I like it because they're chasing down leads. They're trying to break codes, And they're really trying to figure out who the Zodiac Killer was. And any documentary series that is focused on finding out truth, or at the very least, discovering or revealing information that people should know going forward, I think is wonderful. So if that's the thrust of Chasing Earhart, I think it'll be a welcome addition to any channel.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I love the Zodiac case as well. It's one of my favorite personal favorite cases. And I love kind of how you frame that. It's very true. People are interested in the Zodiac Killer case, I mean, all this time later. And Amelia Earhart is still America's sweetheart 80 years after she disappeared. And let's not forget Fred Noonan, who was a very brave man who went on that trip with her. And we're going to be giving Fred his due and his spotlight for sure. And yeah, we are going to be doing a multi-part documentary series, and that's kind of one of the things that sets us apart. That's also never been done when it comes to Amelia Earhart. Our documentary is split into 14 segments, so 14 one-hour segments, and we're even toying with an idea of a 15th hour. So I'm hoping that, you know, once it's all complete and we get it out there, that people will really kind of eat it up and binge watch it. And however we decide to distribute it, it'll be exciting for everybody.
And something else you mentioned is just really showing people who these people were and why they were important. You talk about Fred Noonan, Amelia Earhart, the others that were involved that gave support. I believe her husband was very supportive.
Definitely.
These tasks that people undertake, such as flying around the world, they're not easy to do, especially back then. And was that part of what got you interested, or was it the fact that she was born in Atchison, Kansas?
Well, it's actually, it's interesting. It's kind of reversed, because we just got out here a few months ago, and I'll kind of tell you how that happened. The project is split into four phases until it completes. And the end of phase one was always going to sort of bookend with our trip out in July to Atchison, Kansas, to the annual Amelia Earhart Festival. And we came out here, and we were out here for approximately 4 or 5 days. With the intent of shooting about 4 or 5 folks for interviews, for spotlight interviews, which we'll get into a little bit later. And we ended up shooting 23 individuals over the course of 3 days. It was an exhausting and altogether incredible trip. And we sort of fell in love with the ambiance out here. We are, you know, myself and my wife were born and raised in Southern California. We've been in California all our lives. I had been wanting to sort of leave California and kind of explore some of the Midwestern areas of the United States and even go back east a little bit. Fortunately for me, she's a very explorative kind of woman herself, so she was all for it. And we came here and we just sort of fell in love with it. And, you know, we decided to go ahead and stay here for the duration of the project, which is the fall of 2019. So we're still kind of new to Atchison. We're new to the Midwest, but we're really loving it. And I think being in this town and, you know, living 3 or 4 blocks away, I could walk to Amelia Earhart's birthplace museum home where she grew up, right on the banks of the Missouri River. It's really something special. Atchison is sort of the mecca of Amelia Earhart, with the birthplace home and the Forest of Friendship. And they have the new plane, the Lockheed Electra Tinny Muriel, which is out at the Amelia Earhart Airport. And they're doing an expansion on that right now. Trinity Church, where she was baptized. I mean, if you really want to know sort of about the woman and the woman that she was, and the soul and the spirit of Amelia Earhart, this is where you want to be. So I think it's very interesting that our project is based out of her hometown, and I really love that aspect of it.
I read a novel some time ago as part of research for an episode we did on a man in Missouri who was a nightmare for his town. And the book was titled In Broad Daylight, and the author, Harry McLean, lived in the town where this took place for quite a while before anybody would really talk to him. And he was prepared to stick it out as long as it took for people to start speaking about what happened, because the death of that man was still a mystery. It's almost like the entire town approved his murder, because he was a rapist. He was a thief. He was a bully. And he just used the town as he saw fit. But that's what I'm getting at is you've moved to Atchison, and I'm sure the people there have a great affinity for Amelia Earhart. And then it just makes research that much easier.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you make an excellent point. It's the same reason that, you know, an author would move somewhere if they're writing something, maybe a mystery thriller or something like that, that takes place in Alaska. They're going to maybe move themselves to Alaska for the time being for inspiration. It's kind of the same concept for us. And it really is. You're right on the nail with that. Atchison loves, you know, it's their favorite daughter. They love Amelia Earhart. There's a lot of interesting ambiance and aura in this town when it comes to Amelia. So yeah, it's great being in that supportive environment. The folks here that run the Amelia Earhart Festival every year and do the Amelia Earhart related events throughout the year for the different places that kind of spotlight her life. Or it's really great to be here, and it really kind of, you know, even the house we live in, it's tied, got a little bit of a 6 degrees of separation tie to Amelia Earhart, which is kind of cool. So it's a lot of fun, and it definitely gets the creative juices flowing for myself and some of the team that's here.
Is there anything about Amelia's childhood that stands out to you? Why she got into flying the way she did?
Yeah, you know, she was a very interesting child. She was not a typical little girl, her and her sister, really. But, you know, she was not a typical girl. I think if you're going to research anything that has to do with Amelia Earhart when she was a kid, you know, you've probably heard of the roller coaster incident. And that is an incident that's one of my favorite stories to tell my kid. And it actually took place right at that house a few blocks away. You know, Amelia Earhart was always kind of a daredevil. She always wanted to try new things, and she always wanted to test the limits, even as a kid. And, you know, when she was little, she and her sister, Mariel, and her uncle, they went out there to the backyard area of their grandparents' home in Atchison, and they built a homemade roller coaster. And they built they built this thing that kind of started on the top of the shed and kind of, you know, shot off the top of the shed. And then it kind of got her airborne. And she greased this thing with lard. She greased this homemade track with lard and got in this little wooden homemade roller coaster that she made and promptly crashed it. It was her first official crash as a young kid. And she mentioned to her sister, you know, it's just like flying. It was just like flying. And I think that really that excitement and that kind of, you know, that daredevil inside of her that was kind of born from her as a little girl, I think that kind of rings true throughout her life. The first time she saw a plane, she was really kind of uninterested in it, ironically enough. But the first time she got back in the air when she was older and Frank Hawks took her up famously, she said those words, "After we were 200 feet off the ground, I knew I had to fly." And so it was just something that was just burned into her soul. It's one of those things that I think a lot of people can relate to. Sometimes you don't know what you want to do in life. And, you know, before she went up with Frank Hawks, she held a multitude of jobs. She was a photographer. She was a social worker. She did all kinds of different things. And she went up, with Frank Hawks. She took that first flight. Her dad paid $10 for that first flight. And something turned on inside of her. It was like a light switch. And it just changed her forever. And it ingrained something in her soul that she just had to fly, and she never stopped. She never stopped until she, you know, the very end. I mean, she was constant on that dream. And I think it goes to what you and I were talking about earlier. Flying is really merely just a kind of a catalyst for following your dreams. In this case, she was a pilot. She was a flyer. But it's really about sticking to your guns and following your dreams and having tunnel vision that she was so famous for having. She did not let anything get in her way. And I think all that is birthed out of the kind of life that she lived. She used to go and, you know, shoot rats down in the caves down here. And she was just not your typical girl. And I think at a time like that, when someone is not typical, you know, they grow up to do not typical things. And she's really the poster child for that, especially at that time.
They say, do what you love. And I think it's very true. And I think one of the reasons why it's so true is because you just put more of yourself into something if it's what you love.
Yeah, agreed.
She was 23 years old when she went up on the ride with Frank Hawk, right?
Yes.
It's just amazing because you never know when the realization, this is what I'm supposed to do with my life.
Yeah.
And I think another thing that really highlights just how important flight was for her was when her husband wanted to fly with her, and she was basically saying she could use the fuel more than her husband on that flight, right?
Yeah, you can YouTube that. Those are intimate moments, but you really get to see the kind of woman that she was. And, you know, it was a big deal to her. She took this very seriously. A lot of people would state that, you know, she wasn't the best pilot. And, you know, that may or may not be true. But what I can tell you is that she had something that nobody else had. She had a legendary determination and a legendary fearlessness that is very rare. If she was ever afraid of anything, you know, she didn't show it. And she took piloting and she took flying very seriously. And as you pointed out, even her husband at the time, GP George Putnam, wanted to go. She said, you know, I'd love to have you as much as I'd love to have you. I'd love to have the fuel more.
George Putnam, a very successful man. I think and this is just from my research, I think what he really admired about her was her strength. So when they got married, it was a partnership. She was every bit as equal as he was in his own eyes. And I think he really admired her And you could just tell from the way she talked to him that if she made up her mind on something, that was it.
Yeah. You know, George Putnam, fascinating guy. And, you know, we've been in touch with a lot of the extended family, the extended Putnam family, and they're all great people. And they have very fond memories of George. And, you know, he loved Amelia. I really believe that they were both very fiercely in love with each other. They had a very unorthodox relationship as we look back at it now, because back then, women were taught to love, honor, and obey. That's the big key word, obey your husband. And, you know, even when they did their vows, she stopped the ceremony and had the priest or the pastor who was doing the vows take that word, strike that word out, rather. She did not want to be made to obey her husband. She famously wrote the letter that, you know, if in a year this doesn't work out, you must let me go. She was a very unorthodox person at the time. Now, we look back on that now and, you know, you look at all the things that are going now with women's rights, and, you know, we're still not there. We've come a long way. I think someone like that would be considered a monumental trailblazer, because she really just had a different view of marriage. She didn't want to be tied down to one person, not because she couldn't be faithful, but just because that she really valued her freedom and her career. And she really felt in her heart that she had something more to offer the world than just being married and that's it. But if you look at the other side of that coin, George Putnam was an extremely strong man who, you know, took that and ran with it and said, you know, hey, I'll take you any way I can get you. And he loved her, supported her. There would absolutely not be an Amelia Earhart of this success level if there wasn't a George Putnam. Those two people together were an incredible team. And, you know, she did the flying. He did the promoting. He was one of the world's earliest promoters. He took it, you know, he had it down to a science. I think in this time of social media promotion and all this stuff that we have going on, where, you know, you guys are out there, we're out there, we're promoting ourselves. I mean, these two, especially GP, would have just ate that up. They would be masters at that. And really foundationally speaking, if you're looking at marketing and promoting yourself, you have to look at George Putnam as one of the pioneers of that.
Right. In my notes, I have that their marriage is a partnership with dual control. And as far as the promotion goes, they're not just promoting her flying, they're promoting her ideas and her ideals. And I think that's really important. And it's just amazing to me that we don't have people that can just have a great idea, come out and say it. It's like they have to have some other vehicle. Yeah. You know, just like a really good movie, like take a good horror movie. A good horror movie like Night of the Living Dead isn't just a horror film. It also has social commentary. Yeah. And so it's someone like Amelia Earhart who isn't even probably thinking about trying to get that message across. She just happens to bring it across because that's who she is, and she's chasing her dream.
Absolutely. Yeah, you put it beautifully. Yeah, she's chasing her dream, and you know, she has this talent, this ability, and this raw passion, and this raw talent that she displayed. She was a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants kind of girl, and she took risks that a lot of other pilots might not take. She did these incredible things, and it took a man of George Putnam's caliber to see that. This is a man who was already, you know, a successful publisher. He had written, you know, Charles Lindbergh's book 5 years earlier when he made his famous flight, really kind of catapulted Charles Lindbergh. And he really was the driving force behind Amelia Earhart being shot into the stratosphere. He had her, you know, on lecture routes, on lecture circuits, and he had her hawking everything from cigarettes to, you know, luggage to, you know, her own clothing line. And don't get me wrong. I mean, Amelia Earhart loved clothing. She had all these ideas herself, but this is a man who was able to nurture those ideas and make them a reality. And I think he did that all because he loved her. I mean, I really believe that he loved her. I mean, I think it was, as you mentioned, a mutually beneficial partnership. But we've talked to her extended family and his extended family, and they all have passed down, you know, from their family that, you know, they were very loving behind closed doors, and they're very deeply in love with each other.
So as we know, the reason why so many people know of Amelia Earhart isn't just because of the records that she set as a pilot, but also because she went on a fateful flight where we don't know where she ended up. We don't know if she crashed into the ocean. We don't know if she was taken hostage after landing somewhere. The possibilities are many. I mean, you even have people out there claiming that a UFO took them, you know, some sort of alien spacecraft. Do these theories keep you up at night? Are you constantly wrestling with them? Or when you're working on this, you're just naturally following it and you're open to whatever happens by the end of your documentary?
A good question. I think you go where the evidence leads you. You go where everything takes you. In this case, we have almost 200 people taking us, different directions. And it's interesting because you start out with a project like this and you have a guest list like this and it just grows and grows and grows. And everybody's going to, be working an individual hypothesis regarding what happened to her and Fred Noonan, whether she crashed and sank, whether she was captured by the Japanese, whether she ended up on as a castaway in Nicomororo, whether she made it back and lived her life. There's a lot of different interesting, fascinating hypotheses regarding the case itself. And it really, you have to look at it as just sort of collecting the evidence and just putting it out there for people. I will, it's funny. I will look at a hypothesis like most people. You could look at any one of these hypotheses by itself on its own, and you can be convinced of that particular hypothesis. You really can. But then you get the next one, and you look at the next one, and you think, "Oh man, this has got to be it now. This has got to be the one." And then you hear, you get the third one, and it's kind of rinse, wash, repeat kind of deal. For what we're doing, we have to just sort of look at it and compartmentalize everything and put it out there. I can't really, embed myself with any one hypothesis, because when I do that, or if I should do that, then the project sort of fails on its standard of what we're trying to do. So for us, it's just looking at the evidence almost coldly, really, to be honest with you. Just kind of looking at it like, okay, if you have some evidence you want to put forth, we'll collect it, we'll take it, we'll present it, we'll be the platform for you guys. And then, we'll move on to it. Often, if you look at our podcast episodes, we'll do an episode with a guest that's a Japanese capture hypothesis guest. And the next week, we'll go right to Crash and Sink, or we'll go to Nicomororo. We bounce around a lot. And then we'll talk to some authors, and we'll talk to some astronauts, and we'll talk, it's important to kind of get all that stuff out there. So because of the nature of the project and the way the project works, we have to sort of, look at everything almost coldly, if that makes sense. Just kind of look at the evidence, and it's really not for us to decide who's right. It's really for folks like the general public to decide who they believe is right.
It's just that sometimes when you have a program, and another one is Missing Maura Murray, I'm sure you've heard of that one,
yeah,
where they're just looking at Maura Murray's case, and they have many, many theories that are proposed on their program. And not everyone, but some people come forward and say, why would you have a psychic on to talk about anything? I mean, are you signing off on psychics? Does it cause you to have to give a little disclaimer, like, we're just giving you this information and you can digest it? Or do you feel like the audience just will trust you to be fair and balanced, and you're just including everything, for them to decide?
That's another great question. I think it's a little bit of both, truthfully. We haven't subscribed to any psychics yet. I can tell you that for sure. But I can tell you that in the beginning, when you come up with sort of a business plan, if you look at it that way, of what you're attempting to do, and you have a mission statement for the project, nobody really kind of, people think it's nice, but they don't really believe you until you have something tangible, something they can actually either, digest either visually or audibly or whatever it's going to be. I think for us, people are starting to trust the team. We have a really dedicated, passionate team of individuals who are involved in this project, and they're really starting to trust our judgment, and they're really starting to trust, what we put out there, because we have a little bit of a track record now. In the beginning, getting the project off the ground, it's tough because you don't have that track record to fall back on. Now that people have, almost 19 episodes now to fall back on of a podcast, and then we're starting to release, bits and clips of our spotlight videos and some of our other stuff. They're starting to kind of gather that we are actually doing what we set out to do and what we said we're going to do when we had nothing. So our audience has been very gracious and been very kind to us, and they're largely very supportive in what we're doing. They're starting to trust us a little bit more every week, and it's exciting for us. So I think, to kind of lead these folks and lead the audience to all this evidence and to all this information and let them decide is kind of what we've always wanted to do. And now we're starting to be able to do that. And we're getting feedback from our audience, our podcast audience, and even some of the documentary audience have seen some of the stuff that they're excited for what they're seeing, and they're excited and they're appreciative for what we're doing.
Yeah, the collection and the release of data through one medium, such as your show through the future documentary, is really fascinating. I think it's something that's going to benefit everyone because, like you said before, when you have a documentary, a lot of times it has a singular focus. It might just be her life. It might be a certain theory they're working towards. But when you're just hunting down as much information as you can find, and you're now meeting with and hearing from people around the world who have been obsessed with this case, have put in a lot of hours of their own time, who can't wait to talk to you, I mean, that's just going to be a goldmine.
Yeah, I agree. It's exciting. It's a blessing for our team because it's, you know, we have I joke with my wife, it's almost like whack-a-mole. You know, you have like, we get one and, you know, we take care of one person, then four more pop up. It's been really, and I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier about people trusting us. And that goes not just for our audience, but for our guests. You know, a lot of people are a little bit standoffish in the beginning because the first couple of, you know, episodes we had were with folks that are representatives of Tiger, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, and that hypothesis for the Castaway hypothesis. And so you get two or three episodes that are kind of about that, and people start to think, well, maybe they're kind of in bed with that particular organization. But when you start to put a track record together of all these different things, and you really are talking about everything, it really is sort of exciting. And for us to be sort of a repository, a one-stop shop for Earhart stuff has been really exciting. And, you know, you definitely could do what we're doing about her because she's got such an incredible life. I mean, she had a professional life of approximately 9 years. I mean, it's like you look at this and it's like, that's probably not that hard to cover. It's you would have thought she flew for 100 years with all the data that's out there. So for us, it's exciting to put this all together and just to be that group to kind of, you know, bring everybody together. If we can be a liaison for this group of individuals, these amazing individuals that make up the project roster, then we're honored to do so.
One other thing related to her personal life, have you been able to get in touch with anyone for interviews who knew her really well?
Yes. Well, it's unfortunately a lot of the folks who knew her really well are no longer with us. We do have a couple of members from the family, notably Amy Kleppner, who is Amelia Earhart's niece, who, you know, of course, still vividly remembers her aunt and, of course, was the daughter of Muriel Earhart, Amelia Earhart's sister. And she's an absolutely wonderful woman and very kind and gracious. She sent us some stuff on her mom, on Muriel, because we're going to be doing one of the documentary episodes dedicated to Muriel Earhart and some of the podcast episodes. So she'll be on the show pretty soon. So we have had a lot of touch with some of the extended family that knew Amelia Earhart or, you know, at least have stories of passed down generations of Amelia Earhart. People directly came in contact with her, were close to her. We recently got a video that we're going to be releasing, actually world premiering in the next couple of weeks, regarding a little kid. It's actually a very interesting story. This little kid, his name is Dennis Gray, and he was actually met Amelia Earhart back when he was 4 years old. And I've talked to Dennis Gray, and he vividly remembers this day, which is very interesting to even see that. We actually came in touch and in contact with the original 1937 8mm film that Dennis's father shot just accidentally. They were at an airport, and they were just doing some background shooting. They had just got this camera, and they came across a Lockheed hangar. And lo and behold, Amelia Earhart's Lockheed Electra 10E is in the hangar, and they're working on this 10E, and they're loading it up. And who comes out? Who saunters out but Amelia Earhart? And just by accident, she interacts with these kids while their father is shooting this home video of them. And we have the original 1937 home video shot, and we're actually speaking to Dennis Gray this weekend, and we're going to get his comments on that day, and we're going to put that out. And it's only been seen by maybe 75 or 80 people worldwide so far. It's very, very minuscule, and we're going to put that out worldwide. So that, which is a very unknown story when it comes to Amelia Earhart, is going to be put out there, and we're going to be talking to the family extensively throughout the project. And not only her family, but for George Putnam's family and a lot of those other folks as well.
Back when we covered this case, I was reading up on it thinking, oh, I want to add this to the schedule, but what's our angle? Because Generation Y always has an angle. We don't like to just cover the main story and then just put it out there. We like to find something special about it. And with Amelia, it was reading about how some pilots were talking about how she wasn't that great of a pilot. And I thought to myself, you guys have missed the point. This is a pioneer. And it's not just because she's a woman. I mean, that makes it great too, but it's the fact that she was pushing the envelope. On October 22nd, 1922, she set a new altitude record of 14,000 feet. She didn't let anything hold her back. She said, I'm going to go do this. And that's why her disappearance is so captivating for people, because they didn't want to lose her this way. They wanted her to come back. You know, we wish we had just this almost a more mundane ending of her just coming back and growing old and dying at some point. But instead, she kept pushing the envelope and she went out one day and never returned from that flight. So hopefully at the end, even if you don't have an answer, which I'm sure is probably going to be a near impossible task, you'll at least have built up a great story for people to follow of who Amelia was, why she was so important, what made her tick, and then have those theories presented, those different possibilities for where she might have ended up and where Fred Newton may have ended up.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, this is a woman that had 16 world records when she disappeared, half of which not because she was a woman. You know, she just, these are just world records, just human being world records. She did some incredible things. And I think you hit the nail right on the head. It's all about kind of finding out who this woman was. And, you know, you really can find out a lot of interesting things about someone by looking at their past and looking at how they were brought up, and why she may have made a certain decision might have reflected on the kind of woman, the kind of young girl she was growing up as. All that stuff matters. All that stuff is relevant. And our job is to as non-biased as physically possible, tell the story of all the different disappearance hypotheses, but really talk about how she lived and tell stories like the Dennis Gray story that people might not have ever heard, and talk about the time that she flew the autogyro across Wyoming and crashed it. And this is a woman who walked away from 11 crashes. I mean, it's, you know, in a time of flight that was not, you know, not the birth of flight, but it was early in the, it was in the baby stages of flight. You know, not, and not just Amelia, but all these women that were pioneers of flight, they, I mean, they were incredible spirits and incredible women. And Amelia just, you know, had a fearlessness. She had, you know, you could not tell her no. You could not do that. It was an impossibility. I can't tell you how many no's that woman heard in her life and how many doors were slammed in her face, but it didn't matter. It just didn't matter. Like you said, she had a goal. She had an end game in mind. She knew what she wanted to do, and she went out there and she knocked it out of the park time and time and time again. And that's why we're talking about her. I think the disappearance, the fact that she disappeared mysteriously over the Pacific Ocean, you know, I tell this to people all the time, the United States, especially the United States, we bring people home. We have a military mentality, and we really do want to bring everyone home. And she is the most famous missing persons case of the 20th century, maybe even of all time, definitely in the top five for sure. And we want a finite end to this case. Regardless of what it ends up being, we want to be able to close that door and say, this is definitively what happened to Amelia Earhart and what happened to Fred Noonan. And we can now, you know, their souls can now rest easy, whatever you want it, you know, however you want to spin it. But I think, you know, the disappearance case has been, you know, if you look at her life and you look at what she accomplished and you look at all of that in the 39 years that she lived, all that before you get to the fact that she mysteriously disappears without a trace, no oil slick, no wreckage, no remains, no nothing, just vanish into thin air, apparently. It's got all the makings of a film, really. And you know, it's been done already. So it's exciting to, for us to kind of be on the end of putting this documentary together, putting this project together, putting out all this content and interacting with all the folks who are like in their teens and their early 20s, who are now listening to our show and saying, hey, I didn't know much about Amelia Earhart, but after I listened to, you know, your appearance, or I listened to this show, or I listened to whatever that you were on, or I came across your website and I listened to some of your guests or whatever, I went and got three or four books on her, and I just think she's incredible. And, you know, like, those are the best compliments that we can get as a team. And we're getting those almost daily. And for us to inspire the next potential generation of researchers or historians or authors on Amelia that can really kind of, you know, bring this woman's impact and resonance into the next century is, you know, it's a blessing. I don't have any words to describe it to you, but it's just an absolute honor and a blessing for us to be able to do that.
It reminds me of when they finished shooting the final film in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and Peter Jackson and the crew became a bit emotional, you know, because they'd invested so much time into it. I can only imagine that when you finish this, whatever you want to call finishing it is, maybe it's the release of the documentary and you're promoting it, it will probably be a very strange feeling because you've been putting so much of yourself into the project.
Yeah, you do. I mean, I started this project, as I said in the beginning of the show, about 9 years ago, in sitting in a room by myself doing research, just writing stuff down longhand, just looking up stuff, reading as many books as I could. And then you fast forward to, now, and we're in the middle of the project and it's come out and we're getting such a great warm reception. It's taking off a lot faster. I mean, I remember telling my wife in the beginning, it's going to take years for this thing to even get off the ground. And it's been 6 months and here we are. And it's just, it's incredible. And I think you have it exactly right. When you put so much of yourself into something, when it's done, well, first of all, when you put it out, it's like you're a perfectionist. So you're never going to feel like it's perfect when you watch it or you listen to something. I do that all the time. I don't know if you guys do it, but you hear something like, oh, I could have asked that question. I could have structured that better. I could have, whatever you wanted, however you want to look at it. When you love something as much as, you love what you guys do and we love what we're doing, it's your baby. It's everything that you put your blood, sweat, and your tears into it. And when this is done, it will be emotional. I think when it's out and I wake up the next day, it's going to almost be like, well, like when you work at a job for 30 years and you wake up the next day and you don't have to go to work anymore. And it's just kind of like, well, what now? What do I do now? So it's going to be emotional, I'm sure. And, but right now I'm just looking at the next day, the next week, the next month. We have our calendar up for December and I'm just looking at all those dates and all those things we got to do. And, it goes by fast. It really does. We take it 1 week at a time, 1 month at a time, one podcast at a time. Before you know it, you got 20 episodes and you got 100 episodes. You'd know that more than anybody. You've been doing this since 2012. I mean, can you ever imagine looking back, 5 years later, almost 6 years later, you're still doing this. You're like, God, we got, all these episodes out now. It's pretty incredible.
The workload never ends. And the great thing about it, though, is there's some satisfaction, like you talked about earlier, when you have the feedback. And people really understand where you're coming from and they understand your intentions. So that's the driving force.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you get that positive feedback. And on the other end of the spectrum, you get a little occasional negative feedback. And I remember the very first review we got, I mean, we only got like 20 reviews on iTunes, but we just started the podcast, but the very first review was like a 1-star and it was the most god awful review. I mean, I'm sure you guys have had bad reviews and you just got to look at it. But it was our first one. It was our first review out of the gate. And I remember being crushed on that. I figured like, God, this reviewer just doesn't get it. And I used to really kind of stress over that. And I keep thinking you can relate it back to Earhart herself. I mean, how many times did she get bashed and did she get, talked about and did she get doors slammed in her face? You just have to keep going. If the person that's the center of our project can do that, then that's the very least we can do on her behalf and in her honor. So, now I don't even read. It's early still, but I still don't read the reviews. I just kind of let that go. I let my team handle that. And we just keep doing it. I keep writing my interviews. I keep dealing with every guest at a time, one guest at a time. And, I look to folks like you and folks like Scott and Forrest over at Astonishing Legends. People have been doing this for a lot longer and a lot more successfully than we have. They're where we want to be. You guys are all where we want to be at that time. I look at that and I look at you guys as inspiration and just think, I'm sure you guys have all been through the same thing. I'm not anything special. We've all been there.
Well, internally if you're doing the right thing.
Right. Definitely. And I do. I really feel like I'm a big believer in faith. My wife and I are very big into our faith. And we just believe that it's one of those things where, look what's happened. I mean, we're in Southern California and, this took us across the country. We moved across country to do this and we're here. And, I really believe that, all this stuff, people, places and things and situations would not be moved into your way, into your life if it wasn't meant for something. And I really believe that with my heart and soul. So this has all been very exciting for us. And we're just going to keep going with it until this thing is out. We're in till it's over. And, it's going to be a really fun ride. I can tell you that right now. We got some exciting stuff coming up. We have a really neat event coming up next July at the festival that's never been done. We're attempting it. And so far we've been really successful. We're getting ready to kick off promotion for that in January. And, for your listeners that are in Kansas City and all those areas, you guys are all welcome to come out. We'll talk about that event hopefully in the next few weeks here.
Well, speaking of that, how can people get in touch with you or find your episodes or get updates on your documentary?
Yeah, so very easy. We're very fortunate. We have we're very transparent. So we have a really interesting team that works our website, works our social media. We are on social media. You can follow us with the handle at Chasing Earhart, facebook.com/ChasingEarhart. If you stick that in, stick Chasing Earhart in any social media search engine, you'll find us. Twitter at Chasing Earhart, all that good stuff. Of course, the website, that's sort of my baby personally. I kind of designed that website from the ground up and took it and turned it over to our web team who runs it now. We are very unique in the instance that we have somebody almost all the time monitoring the website. Not all the time, because I do have to sleep, but most of the time there's someone available to live chat with you on the website. So you can hop on chasingearhart.com. You can listen to the podcast. You can stream it right there on the website, all 19 episodes of the podcast so far. We're reading episode 20, and we have about 37 episodes already recorded, another 47 scheduled to record in the next 3 months. So we're going to be doing this for a while. You can check out that website, chasingearhart.com. You can chat with our team. You can ask them a question about anything on the episode, about the project, whatever you want. If anybody wants to reach out to me personally, I make myself readily available. My email is right on the site. It's just chris@chasingearhart.com. I'm always happy to talk Amelia Earhart with everybody out there, fans, authors, you know, people that are excited about the disappearance or her life, whatever it is. You know, I'm always willing. My door is always open for that. And we're out there, man. We have our YouTube channel. You can search Chasing Earhart. You can see some of the spotlight clips. We just uploaded our third spotlight clip. We'll have about 150 of those by the time the project ends. We'll release one every couple of weeks. So you can get to know these individuals. So by the time the documentary drops in 2019 and these people pop up, you'll know exactly who they are. You can reference them, you know, why they're relevant to Amelia Earhart's life or the case or whatever you want to look at. So we really have a strong online presence. We're trying to make ourselves as transparent as possible so we can chat with everybody out there about Amelia Earhart.
Very good. Well, it was a pleasure to speak with you, Chris, and best of luck with this project. And I know we're planning to speak with you before too much longer.
Yes, definitely. You guys are going to be invited guests to the project. We're going to get with both of you and hopefully have you guys collectively together. We can come out there and shoot with you since we're physically we're in close proximity. And we're honored to be part of this podcast. I mean, like I said, we're big fans of Generation Y and what you guys have done. So it's been an absolute honor to chat with you tonight. Thank you for having me.